I wish you good luck. O Brahma, you may ask for me, the giver of all benediction, all that you may desire. You may know that the ultimate benediction, as the result of all penances, is to see me by realization. Report by Srila Prabhupada. The ultimate realization of the Supreme Truth is knowing and seeing face to face the personality of Godhead. Realization of the impersonal Brahman and localized Paramatma features of the personality of Godhead is not ultimate realization. When one realizes the Supreme Lord, one does not struggle hard to perform such penances. The next stage of life is to discharge devotional service to the Lord just to satisfy Him. In other words, one who has realized and seen the Supreme Lord has attained all perfection because everything is included in that highest perfectional stage. The impersonalists and the pseudo-mystics, however, cannot reach this state. So the translation again. I wish you good luck. O Brahma, you may ask for me, the giver of all benediction, all that you may desire. You may know that the ultimate benediction is the result of all penances, is to see me by realization. So, we have the conversation that is taking place between Lord Brahma and the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And Lord Vishnu, the Supreme Lord, is offering his benedictions to Brahma. So Srila Prabhupada points out in the purport that actually to have direct realization of the Supreme Lord on a personal level is the highest stage of self-realization. So in this world, there are many different concepts of the goal of life. Many people, of course, are living on a platform of gross material existence. They're concerned merely with maintaining and fending for the material body and the different bodily relations. And they don't think of anything beyond that. Then there are those who concern themselves with religion in different forms. The Vedic scriptures provide a very systematic analysis of all the different types of religion that you can find within the world. And this is quite interesting. One objection people will often have to religious teachings is that they are sectarian, and it is just a matter of converting people from one faith into another. Ask, well, what is the point in that? For example, in India, Srila Prabhupada was challenged in that way. He was told that, well, the Christians have come and converted Hindus to Christianity, and Muslims have also converted various Hindus into Muslims. Now you're converting Christians and Muslims into Hindus, so what's the point of it all? You just have all kinds of different sectarian opinions. And really, one opinion is no better or worse than the others. Or perhaps some will say that they're all bad, and that we should get away from such things. Because ultimately, they're just opinions. And everyone has their scripture, everyone has their different religious teachings, their different prophets and sages and so forth. So, and they all contradict one another. So, where is the truth? Each person belonging to a particular religious sect will say, well, I have the truth, and those other people don't have the truth. But then the other people will say the same thing about him. So then what is the solution? So it is interesting to see that the Vedic literature contains an analysis of all the different manifestations of religion that you have in this world. And you can see then how all of these different sectarian viewpoints fit together. So, of course, this is a very elaborate subject matter about which many books could be written. But briefly, you can see how, from the perspective of the Vedic literature, it is possible to understand all different manifestations of religion. Now, if there is another system of religion or philosophy on this planet for which it is also possible to do that, then that could be considered as possibly on the same platform as the Vedic literature, or possibly superior. But if there is, in fact, no other system of religion or philosophy on this planet which can encompass within itself all of the different philosophies, all of the different expressions of religion, and explain them, and classify them in an intelligent and understandable fashion, then one would have to conclude that the Vedic system is actually superior to all the others. In other words, there is a criterion for deciding how to choose among all kinds of different conflicting doctrines and so forth. So, of course, to establish this basic point, namely that the Vedic system can include all of the other systems within itself and explain them, and that no other system, in fact, can do that with all other systems, that's something that can be pursued on various levels. You can give sort of a brief summary of the argument that can be made, or you can go into extensive detail. And ultimately the way it works is to convince some people you'll have to go into great detail, and there will be other people who you can't convince anyway because their minds are made up about various different shades of opinion. But in any case, one can give a brief outline of the situation of different religions as explained by the Vedic literature. So in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains that there is religion in the modes of goodness, passion, and ignorance. And under these different categories, you see different manifestations. So that's one way of categorizing things, according to the modes of material nature. Then there are the basic categories of karma kanda, jnana kanda, and vipassana kanda. So that's another way of categorizing. So actually, if you look at those categories, you wind up with 9 different divisions. As you multiply, you take each of the categories of one type and divide it into 3 by categories of the other type. So, as far as goodness, passion, and ignorance is concerned, you can see, for example, that many manifestations of religion around the world are oriented towards the worship of ghosts and spirits. So this is described in the Bhagavad Gita as religion in the mode of ignorance. And this goes on. It's very popular. There are many different categories of this. From what is called spiritualism in Western countries to different kinds of shamanism and so forth in different societies around the world. Some ethnographers have made studies of shamanism. This is a quite popular topic in what's called cultural anthropology. And it's interesting to see that all over the world you have certain basic systems of belief involved with worship of ghosts and spirits and so forth. And these different systems are quite distinctive. You find the same patterns recurring in North America, South America, all across Northern Asia, from Siberia over into Lapland, and so forth. So this is religion in the mode of ignorance. This type of religion, by the way, involves real phenomena. Mode of ignorance refers to the fact that it causes one to focus on qualities and psychological modes of activity which would tend to bring one lower in the cycle of birth and death within the material world. But it doesn't mean that the things that the people are talking about are not real. In fact, if you look at these different categories of phenomena, you'll see that there's a lot of evidence that things really happen in these different mode of ignorance manifestations of religion. Now, an interesting development is that in modern American society, you find a lot of talk, especially in recent years, about such things as out-of-body experiences and past life memories and so on and so forth. Actually, if you look at this from a broader perspective, you can see that these people are approaching the platform of ignorance and the mode of religion and the mode of ignorance. Because all of the different manifestations that they're talking about are, for example, standard features of this broad category of religion you could call shamanism. For example, the shamans would typically travel out of their bodies and engage in different activities, and they would come back into their bodies. So nowadays you hear about people having out-of-body experiences. And this is considered in modern Western society to be a very controversial topic. As far as science is concerned, such things don't really exist. They must be some kind of illusion or hallucination. Of course, it's also interesting to note that no one really knows what hallucination is. What is a hallucination, anyway? How does that work? So you could say then that in modern society, you have people approaching religion in the mode of ignorance. Actually, many New Age ideas of spirituality involve a gradual process in which people in modern society are approaching religion in the mode of ignorance. They haven't quite attained to that platform yet, but they're heading in that direction. So the worship of the demigods would correspond to, well, pretty much, it depends on how they are worshipped. Religion in the mode of passion or religion in the mode of goodness. Religion in the mode of pure goodness would be the worship of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Now, another factor, of course, is this division into karmakanda, jnanakanda, upasanakanda, and so forth. So, many manifestations of religion that you have all over the world are related to material goals. And so that would basically be the category of karmakanda. So that's very well developed in the Vedic society. Especially you have the worship of demigods for the purpose of gaining different material ends. And this is very standard in, well, for example, typical forms of Christianity. You have people also worshiping Jesus Christ, or God as they conceive of him, in order to obtain different material goals. Then Jnanakanda would be the religion of the philosophers. The basic idea of Jnanakanda is through the transformation of one's consciousness, and through the acquisition of knowledge, one wants to come to some higher stage of realization. And typically it is concluded that the ultimate stage of realization, as conceived by the process of Jnanakanda, is something impersonal. It's actually natural, using this process of obtaining knowledge, to come to impersonal conclusions. So that's very elaborately developed in the, of course, in Vedic literature and in Vedic tradition. And of course, you have the age-old debate between the Mayavadis and the Vaishnavas in India. Of course, in the West, most knowledge of Hinduism, especially in Western universities, and also in what you could broadly call popular Hindu movements in America, the New Age, which has large elements of Hinduism in it, and the different yoga groups and so forth. All of this is basically devoted to the impersonal philosophies that have arisen within India. There's relatively little knowledge of the Vaishnava philosophy or personal theism, and of the fact that over the millennia, there have been ongoing debates between the Vaishnavas and the impersonalists. Nor is it known that the Vaishnavas have traditionally won these debates. But it takes research to find that out. I'll mention, interestingly enough, as an aside, let's see, I forget the name of this particular scholar, but there was a scholar who was writing the standards in the logical scholar from some reputable university, who was writing about the commentary on the Vedanta Sutra by Ramanuja. And he said that actually Ramanuja's commentary is superior to that of Shankaracharya. From a scholarly viewpoint, he said that Ramanuja actually addresses the issues involved in the Vedanta Sutra in a more accurate way, in a way that is more true to the actual text of the Vedanta Sutra than Shankaracharya. So you have a scholar recognizing this fact. So in any case, this debate is not well known, but you have this long-standing conflict between impersonalism and personal theism. So if you look at other manifestations of religion, you'll also see the same themes being reflected. For example, if you look at Christianity, you'll see that the Christianity, in its original form and in its more popular forms, is based on a type of personal theism. God is conceived of as a person who personally created heaven and earth, and who ordained things, who created with his word. Now, what is the word of God? You think if one speaks of the word of God, one must be thinking of some person who pronounces the word. Generally, words are spoken by persons. That's the implication. So the original concept, pretty much, in Christianity was that you have God as a person. God has his chosen people. He chastises them, and so on and so forth. But if you look at what you could call philosophical Christianity, you'll find that God has become an impersonal principle, and that ideas regarding God as a person are regarded as being somewhat naive. This is the typical response of the impersonalist to the personal theist. You will say the personal theist is, well, intellectually not really there. He's definitely naive. So you see this going on in Christianity. In Islam also, there are impersonalist sects. For example, the Sufis are impersonalists. So the impersonalists tend to either intellectualize about the ultimate absolute truth, or they're prone to engage in some form of meditation in which they try to visualize some kind of light or something like that. So you see this all over the world also in different manifestations. Now, the concept of a supreme person who is the original cause of all causes is also very widespread all over the world. If you look at the standard propaganda from the coming from Christian sources, you'll hear that monotheism really was first came about in the Jewish tradition, and then the Christians perfected it. This is at least what I was always taught. So the idea is that everyone who came in an earlier phase in history was polytheistic. These people were worshippers of many gods. And you hear that, well, primitive people personified the forces of nature and created various ideas of different types of gods. And so you have the god of storms, that would be Indra, and the god of the wind, that would be Vayu. And of course, there's the ocean god, that would be Varuna, and so on and so forth. So they worshipped many gods, but then a higher development in thought occurred in Israel, and they developed the idea of the one God, So this is this concept is propounded by the you could say the believers in Judeo-Christian tradition, who would say that actually these people were the first to realize that there really is just one God. And then, of course, there are the skeptics of Judeo-Christian tradition who will say that, well, actually, these people originally believed in many gods, and at a certain point they went through a philosophical transformation and began talking about only one God. And you can still see signs of that in the Bible. For example, Elohim, one of the Hebrew words for God, is a plural form, and actually that shows they were worshiping many gods. So these arguments are made. It is interesting to note, though, that if you look around the world, you'll find that belief in an original supreme person is very common. For example, if you go across, let's say, northern Asia, at the different look at the different Siberian tribes, Mongols and Tatars and Austriacs, and so on and so forth, Yakuts, there are many of them. Practically all of them have a belief in a supreme person who is the original creator. Now, if you go to darkest Africa, you'll find the same thing is true. If you look at all the different tribes of Africa, you'll find that most of them also believe in an original supreme creator. Now, pretty soon people are going to start thinking, maybe it's primitive to accept an original supreme creator. If you go to Australia and look at the Aborigines, you'll find that many of their tribes believe in an original personal creator. Now, it's interesting to see what happens with these different groups. Very often you'll find that the personal creator is not worshipped. Instead, you'll find that the personal creator generated at some point a hierarchy of different gods or demigods, and very often those are worshipped preferentially by the different people. Sometimes they just don't pay much attention to the personal creator. In other cases, they have an explicit philosophy that says, well, the personal creator is so far away from people of this earth that there's no point in worshiping him. He doesn't care about us. He just created things from his point of extreme aloofness, set everything in motion, and then left it up to the secondary controllers, the demigods, to tend to everything. And then there are even some, I've heard of this with regard to some African tribes, who will say, well, you shouldn't worship the personal creator for material ends. That would be offensive. So therefore, they don't worship him. They figure, well, we have material goals, and it's offensive to worship the original personal creator for material ends, so therefore we don't worship him. Many of these people explicitly worship ghosts and spirits because they think, well, the kinds of goals we have can be satisfied by this kind of worship. And that's true, actually, because typically when they worship, they want to do something like, you know, get revenge against somebody, or get some money, or cure some illness, or you know, get somebody to marry them, or something of this nature. Especially desires for revenge can be more appropriately satisfied by approaching the ghosts and spirits and so forth. Even the demigods aren't so much interested in those kinds of things. So, then of course there's the whole topic of bhakti. So, the highest understanding that you have in the whole sphere of religion is that there is an original personal creator, and the purpose of our lives, the lives of all the different living beings, is to serve that original creator. So that concept also will be found in various forms in different cultures and societies around the world. For example, in Christianity, you also find that. But one could argue, I think reasonably, that the highest development of the philosophy of bhakti is to be found in the Vedic literature, specifically in the Bhagavatam and in the different traditions of the Vaishnavas, which are centered on the Bhagavatam. I suspect that if someone did make an objective study of bhakti and its different manifestations around the world, one would be able to see that, number one, it does play a fundamental role all over the world in different religions. And Srila Prabhupada has also made the point that even to attain these various other goals of religion, bhakti is required in some form. So this would suggest then that you should find it everywhere in some stage of its manifestation. And I think objectively you would find that this is true. But in its highest and purest form, I think also it could be objectively argued that this is really to be found in the Vedic literature. So, let's see. And there was another point that just eluded me. So, anyway, these are some observations on how this whole picture can be, of different manifestations of religion can be looked at. It's something that can be gradually developed. Actually, Srila Prabhupada said that he wanted his men to head up the departments of religion in all of the different universities. It's one of the things that the devotees are supposed to do. So if that is done, then those devotees will have to confront all these different issues. I suspect that that can be done in a very systematic way. So I'll stop there. Are there any questions or comments? Yeah?
Referring to the original personal conceptions of the Judeo-Christian religions, and as opposed to the philosophical, intellectual understanding. So I just articulate something in this regard. When I first went to Israel about 12 years ago, I was already more or less practicing Krishna consciousness, and I went with a tour, kind of like in the Negev, the central area, and they took us to one real ancient synagogue, like thousands of years old in the Jericho area. And on the floor of the synagogue, there was like a mosaic. And it looked, what came to my mind, it looked like a Greek sun god or something. I mean, it was real, a figure. It looked like a sun god of the Roman Greek era. And if you ever go to synagogues today, at any point, what's very striking, synagogues or mosques, is there is no form of any sort, it's not even rabbis, or what to speak of God. There's no form of any sort. Anyhow, so the tour guide seriously tried to convince us that this was a decoration. That it had nothing to do with, there was no worship of this form, because we know that as Jews, we don't worship form. But it's very clear what they were doing, 2,000 years ago when the synagogue was built. So what actually happened was it was a very personal form of worship in Judaism until fairly recently, about 900-1,000 years ago, when one philosopher, the Rambam, Moses Maimonides, he basically took the scriptures and he made an interpretation based on Aristotle, who's just a heathen according to traditional Judaism, but he really liked Aristotle, and he made a whole impersonal interpretation. And he was completely rejected. But somehow or other, he had a few followers, and after about 10 or 12 generations, his interpretations became accepted it's said from Moses to Moses, from the original Moses, and then the next was Moses Maimonides. So that today, you can't even question his impersonal interpretations, which are based on Aristotle. But if you look at this, what the synagogues looked like 2,000 years ago, they're completely contrary to what they're doing today.
Yeah, well, that's very interesting. It looks like he was the Shankaracharya of Judaism.
Exactly.
Which also illustrates the basic point I was making, that you can take the subject matter we study in Krishna consciousness, and from that perspective, you can understand all kinds of things that are happening in the history of religion in different parts of the world. Yeah.
I have a question about that analysis that you presented as a perspective at the very beginning of the class. So if we take, say, the Vedic perspective, then we analyze all the other religions, and you were saying they could fit within different categories from that Vedic perspective. Is it a question that analyzation can be done, but then these traditions are rejected, or are they found valuable? Because how others might receive such an analyzation will depend very much on whether we come to the conclusion useless or come to the conclusion some value. So,
So the analysis, the question is, what value judgments are coming along with this analysis? And of course, there are value judgments, inevitably so. They don't have to necessarily be presented in a way that will antagonize people. One thing you observe in some religious traditions is exclusivism. And of course, this is one of the issues that causes many people to be very wary concerning religion. Of course, the most famous exclusive religion that we know of today would be Christianity in its various forms. Because there the idea is our way is the truth, and that's it. Everything else is false. In fact, to be explicit, everything else is the work of the evil counterpart of God. Actually, I understand this really comes from Iranian dualism called Mazdaism, the idea that there's a God of good and a God of evil. So anyway, so our religion comes from the God of good and all the rest comes from the evil one. So inevitably, one is forced to have a value judgment with respect to that approach to religion. One would have to say that that is a phenomenon that does arise based on different features of human nature. Now, also, if you look, say, at worship of ghosts and spirits, if we say that's religion in the mode of ignorance, the very choice of words suggests that that is something that is not good. On the other hand, we don't say that it's entirely false. And when I was earlier saying that in modern civilization, we have people approaching religion in the mode of ignorance. It's actually a fact that they're making advancement as they make that approach. That shows that their position is not very elevated. But actually, that's a fact. If you have people who are brought up thinking that there's no such thing as the soul, there's no life after death, you're simply an arrangement of chemicals that has evolved by natural processes and chance and so forth. If such people come to the conclusion that, well, maybe there is some kind of soul that does survive the death of the body or can function separately from the body, then they're making advancement. But they're actually advancing to a level of understanding that is extremely traditional among Eskimos, Australian Aborigines, people in the Congo jungles. All of them understood that the soul exists. This was very standard all over the world, and still is, actually. But it's in modern society that we have been able to escape from that understanding and come to the realization that we're nothing but chemicals. So actually, one can make advancement by coming up to the platform of religion in the mode of ignorance. So therefore, we're not saying that all these different manifestations of religion are all bad. Our real perspective would be that these all represent different stages of consciousness for the conditioned spirit soul. And as long as the spirit soul is making progress upward in consciousness, that is good for that soul. But of course, ultimate upward progress does not become, let us say, secure until one reaches the stage of realization of the Supreme Personality of Godhead in bhakti. When one has not yet attained that stage, one's realization can always be reversed. One can go back down in the cycle of transmigration and so forth. So Nonetheless, though, different modes of religion do involve progress in consciousness for the different people who are engaged in them. And it's simply a fact that some people are going to be engaged in religion at certain levels. Our preaching is not going to change that because it's a matter of the consciousness of those people. At the same time, we can provide a path towards higher understanding for all those people in the world who are ready to take advantage of it. Yeah?
Someone might consider it glib to you dismiss, you know, the fact that out-of-body experiences compare them to, like, the mode of ignorance, because so many people who are actually practicing vegetarianism, so-called slightly sattvic people in the West, are also aspiring to this type of realization. And it's kind of a cloudy explanation for you to lump everybody in and say it's mode of ignorance.
I'm not proposing to say to such people that it's mode of ignorance. That would be obviously it would not have a good impact.
I'm saying not to even just pretend it, but to think it, because it seems to me that there are people who approach from the stage of Sattva, you know, or the stage of Tamas, who seem to have lumped it all in. I mean, not that.
Well, no, the point that I was making...
It seems like the New Age movement, there are many people who are vegetarian who aren't totally in the mode that they don't take drugs. I mean, just like some of these local people around here, mm-hmm. Temple of the Universe people, they're not really in the mode of ignorance that much.
Well, then they're not. So...
But it seems like the general trend of those people, there are a fair amount, if not half or more, that aren't. In other words, talking about out-of-body experience or... Not just simply.
No, if you look at out of body experiences, one thing that you see, I'm not speaking necessarily of people who are trying to become vegetarian and so forth. It is sattvic, for example, to become vegetarian on the basis of not being violent towards other forms of life. That's basically sattvic, right? Of course, Buddhism would be one of the famous religious and cultural movements which stresses not being violent to other forms of life. That's an example indicating the platform at which that kind of philosophy is situated. But as far as out-of-body experiences are concerned, the concept that there is something which one could call the soul, which can exist outside of the body, and which would survive the death of the body, that kind of idea is becoming more widespread at the present time amongst many people who are not particularly inclined towards being vegetarian necessarily. A lot of people talk about out-of-body experiences who eat meat. I was recently at a conference where, for the purpose of preaching, I sat down at a big table full of people who were sawing into steaks and all kinds of things like that. And they were talking about such things. I also noticed what they were drinking. It contained what is known as the stool of yeast. So ethanol, fortunately, not methanol. But these people are actually the ones I had in mind when I was saying that they're coming up to religion and the mode of ignorance. And we shouldn't disparage all the tribal people and so forth also. The use of negative terminology actually should be avoided, and for that reason, I wouldn't recommend saying to people what you believe is religion in the mode of ignorance. That wouldn't be good. That'd make people angry. No point in doing that. But as far as the classifications given in Vedic literature are concerned, we can look at things objectively from that point of view. So it's actually a fact that if you look at all these different tribal peoples, people who traditionally worship ghosts and spirits and so forth, they all believe in the soul. They all believe that once they die, they're going to go to some other place, and so on and so forth, practically speaking. So you have people in modern society who are coming to that position. Now, another point I could make that could be of some interest is that if people in modern society come to that realization, they may do so in a more solid way than some of the people who traditionally had that understanding, in the sense that they've had to fight their way to that understanding through different contrary philosophies and modes of thought. Therefore, once they arrive at that platform, it's something much more solid. They have a much higher level of realization than people, say, in some traditional tribal society. In fact, if you look at the traditional tribal society, you'll see that as soon as they come in contact with, say, modern scientific teaching, it just wipes out their traditional system of thought. And pretty soon, you have a new generation that forgets the old ways entirely. So, therefore, in that sense, people who are coming to these realizations in modern society may do that on a higher platform because they have to fight for that kind of realization. Yeah?
Just a comment. Yeah, sometimes I have to be a little careful about our analyzation of different practices and the modes of nature. Because ultimately, Krishna's point in Gita is that unless you follow Shastra, specifically the Vedas, then it's not really the mode of goodness. Because the demarcation point for the mode of goodness is to accept that that kind of stricture on one's life. Even if you accept other Shastic strictures, those Shastras may be obviously religion in these different modes. Of course, so obviously vegetarianism, as you pointed out, maybe you step in that direction, and then you analyze, well, is there sexual restrictions or this or that, and you find that it may not be as goodness oriented just because they're sitting in the woods, as you might.
Yeah, well, you see, the modes are always mixed until you come to pure goodness. And so you can have an element of goodness coming into somebody's life, mixed in with passion and ignorance in various complex ways. And so it's just like mixing the three primary colors and getting all kinds of different pictures that's in color. The combinations are extremely complex. But my basic point was the Vedic literature does provide a framework for analyzing and understanding all of these things. Now, the question of how you present that framework, of course, is another thing, because one has to be diplomatic, of course, in presenting things to different people. It wouldn't be good to say, you're in the mode of ignorance. But, of course, we have to be careful that we're not in the mode of ignorance. Let's see. One more question.
There's theoretically understanding that we're not this body. There's actual realization of it. Will the actual realization of that be a manifestation of the goodness? Or is it possible to realize it in another mode?
Well, mode of goodness would correspond to truth, and mode of ignorance corresponds to illusion. So then you can ask, well, how can it be that someone in the mode of ignorance knows anything that is true? Well, the answer, of course, is that things are always mixed. As I was saying, these people who worship ghosts and spirits know that there are such things, and that's true. So that's some truth that they have, so that must be goodness. Whereas mode of ignorance tends to be associated with dreams and illusions and so forth. Of course, you'll see that these people are involved in different dreams and illusions to a large extent also. They may be approaching the spirits in order to gain some material goal, which a person on a higher platform of realization will see as utterly a wretched thing to pursue. But in general, any truth that one knows would be in the mode of goodness. It's an actual truth.
But it would be theoretical. Actually, Brahman realization. Then, if one is actually Brahman realized, then these lower, they have no importance to him anymore. So, in a sense, it's just theoretical. They understand, they've heard from authority,
yeah.
But they're not actually on the platform of that, not this platform. Is that right?
Which people are you referring to?
Like you were saying, some of the religions.
Well, some people actually have experience indicating that they're not the gross body. You see, in realizing you're not the body, the first step is to realize you're not the gross body. Then you can think you're the subtle body. You see, that's an intermediate stage. there are many people who have actual realization that they're not the ghost body. In fact, I've met some people who've had heart attacks and who had out-of-body experiences. They're convinced that they're not the ghost body. They think that's an established fact. They know. But they have no idea about the distinction between the soul and the subtle body. So that's another whole level of realization.
That's not
good. Yeah. So, I'll go to Shubhavan.